Looking back now, it all seems so simple. Jim Clark, Lotus 25, checkered flag. In 1963 alone, he won 70% of the Formula One championship races, 7 out of 10, and 12 additional races in Formula One, sports cars, touring cars, and USAC. Jim Clark, quite simply, was motor racing in the 1960s. His dark complexion and dazzling smile melted the hearts of all who met him or even observed him from afar. Then there was the dark blue helmet, used only occasionally with a white peak back in 1963, the light blue Dunlop overalls and the stringback gloves, upgraded to Jim Clark's own brand in 1965. All were the epitome of Formula One style in the days when style was a function of dignity and respectability. At Goodwood on the Sussex Downs, he raced everything from Formula One, Lotus 25, 33, to Formula Juniors, Lotus 18, GT cars, Aston Martin DBR1 300, Aston Martin DB4 GT Zagato, sports cars, Lister Jaguar, Tejero Jaguar, Lotus 30, and touring cars, Lotus Cortina. Clark, indeed, won the last Formula One race ever to be staged at Goodwood in the Works Lotus 33, the Sunday Mirror Trophy on Easter Monday, 1965. Many are the images of Jim Clark. He was indecisive. He was nervous. He was a front runner less comfortable within the pack. He was an indispensable half of the Chapman-Clark monopoly. He was, behind the scenes, a mild-mannered shepherd, much as that other Clark, Kent, was a bespectacled newshound when he wasn't saving the world. You can make Jim Clark as complex as you like. For me, though, Jim is the driver I saw working magic at Warwick Farm, Sydney, from 1965 through to 1968. Warwick Farm, designed by Jeff Sykes of the BARC, with its grass and its white picket fences, was in many ways an Australian Goodwood. I saw Jim win at the farm in the Lotus 32B, the Lotus 39, and then the Goldleaf Lotus 49. And then a few weeks after that February race in 1968, and thus a few weeks before we lost him, I chatted to Jim for half an hour or so over a coffee at Sydney Airport. He was relaxed, open, and every bit the motor racing enthusiast. We spoke about his upcoming test of the Lotus 56B turbine at Indy. We chatted about his prospects with the Lotus 49. I was just a kid whose face probably seemed a little familiar, so frequently had I been out to Mascot Airport to see him come and go. But Jim spoke in detail and with a calm, quiet passion. Curious was a word he used a lot. He was curious to see how the turbine would run at Indianapolis. He didn't use the Indy diminutive, as I recall. He was curious, too, about the new Cosworth-powered cars he'd be racing against in 1968. And I think curiosity, looking back, to some extent, was a large part of what Jim Clark was all about. People often ask me whether racing is more about man or machine, he once said, about which is more important. I don't think of it in those terms. For me, it's a personal thing, a personal satisfaction of driving a motor car to what I feel is the machine's limit and still to be in full control of that machine when it's on the limit. That's the greatest feeling I get from motor racing. Jim's parents did all they could to dissuade him from racing. The sport was dangerous, expensive, and time-consuming. After a race at Crimond in the north of Scotland, however, Jim's curiosity was kindled. There was no turning back. I suppose, in a way, if one had set out to be a Grand Prix driver from the start and made it a life's ambition, I would feel a greater sense of achievement, he told Raymond Baxter after winning the 1963 World Championship. But in a way, I almost fought more against a career in motor racing rather than for it. I didn't want to spend more than the odd weekend away from home, and it got to the stage where my father was asking about what I hoped to gain from an expensive hobby. I used to argue back that I could make a hobby pay, and this is in a way how it really started. I got the chance to do it professionally. Ultimately, though, continued Clark, I entered motor racing as a curiosity. When I was at school and when Ian Scott Watson was racing, I wanted to see what it was like. I wondered what it would be like to race, to be on a track. The curiosity has remained ever since. I wonder what it's like to drive different types of car. In a way, I've always plunged in at the deep end. I haven't known a damn thing about what I'm going to do, and I can always think, if I don't like it, I don't have to do it, and I can always get out of it. His sublime talent was God-given, that's a certainty. Jim excelled at sport, particularly cricket, and was also a superb pilot. Beyond that, however, Jim worked hard at his profession. He was intellectually organised and very descriptive of the car. Colin Chapman then joined up the dots. A good example of his thinking was seen at the 63 French Grand Prix at Reims, his third successive championship race win that season. Reims was super fast in a 1.5-litre Formula One car. Its long straights would always favour the most powerful engines. The first corner, bypassing Gur Village, was one of the quickest and most demanding on the calendar. It was where Luigi Musso had lost his life in 1958. Jim's Climax engine Lotus 25 was the class car of 1963, but there was little doubt about the power superiority of the Ferraris and BRMs. On this track, even more than at Spa, the 25 was potentially going to struggle. The 25, funnily enough, was handling better there than it ever had before or since, Jim subsequently told Graham Gould. On the fast ones, the very fast corners, I could set it up with a whacking great drift and bury my foot in it and go through these corners at such a rate that I didn't think it was possible. I sensed this in practice, and I had it all worked out in the race. I knew Graham had got his BRM monocoque that didn't handle that well, and I was banking that if I could get away before him, and he was second, by the time we got round all these fast corners, I might just be able to make a break from the toe. I told Colin before the race, if I haven't done it by five laps, I'll just sit back and let them fight it out. And one lap had gone, and I just kept going without straining the car in braking or cornering, or the engine at all. At the end of the race, when I was losing power, the telltale was at 9.6. And we'd allowed 9.8. Even in the opening burst, I hadn't even used all the engine. The Lotus 25-33, of course, is in many ways synonymous with Jim Clark. Its monocoque chassis introduced a glamorous new reclined driving position to Formula One, and with its development came changes in safety. Herbert Johnson and Evoque helmets gave way to the ubiquitous Bell Magnum, the Les Leston, and then to the Buco. Clark usually wore a handkerchief or fire-resistant face mask, but sometimes, as at Reims in 63, he just taped up his face for protection against debris. It wasn't love at first sight, however. Colin is always one for trying ideas, recalled Jim in a conversation with Alan Brinton. I know that the monocoque had been thought about quite a bit towards the end of 1961. There was something brewing about the time of the motor show at Earl's Court, but Colin wouldn't tell me what it was, as I hadn't actually signed with him for 1962. All he did say was that he had something radically different that he wanted to try. It wasn't until I got back from the South African races, which Jim dominated, that I became fairly well aware of what was going on. We then had the Lotus 24 in hand, but as yet no Climax V8 for it. But when I returned from South Africa, the initial work started on the 25, with the plumbing and fittings being laid out. At that time, it was intended to have a steering column gear change, but I couldn't get the pendulum pedals working to my liking, and there were a lot of conferences about that. Colin managed eventually to find enough room for a conventional gear change, but in fact, the whole job took longer than it was originally intended. It was May before the car was ready. I'd done no testing with it when we took it to Zandvoort, and originally I was going to race the 24, which was going very well, and Trevor Taylor was going to run the 25. In the end, it was decided that I should have a bash of the 25 in the race. Not surprisingly, we ran into trouble. Jim was leading when he retired. But I suppose it taught us a thing or two. The very reclined driving position made visibility difficult, particularly on sharp corners. But I eventually got used to it. When pushed to talk about his talent, Jim always cited concentration as one of the key elements. I've got a great theory, he said in 63, when speed limits on the road were becoming a hot topic, that accidents aren't caused by speeding, as everybody thinks. They're caused by lack of concentration. This is one of the great things in motor racing, concentration. Quite often, when I'm on the track and I want to go faster, I don't drive any faster, I just concentrate harder, which makes me go faster, by concentrating on the braking, by concentrating on the way through the corner, or the amount of throttle or power I can get on out of the corner, just by concentrating that little bit harder all round. LJK Setright, the erudite journalist, engineer for Car magazine, now sadly deceased, was involved in a tire analysis program in the mid-1960s. His studies left him in no doubt about why Clark was so good. The tests we conducted were based on the principle of trying to make the tires work at their best. The fascinating result was how they showed up the superiority of Clark. I was privy to a lot of other information about the other drivers. We used to measure the wear of each tire at the end of the race, and in this way we could work out how much of each tire each driver was using. Dan Gurney would use the fronts more than the back, Jack Brabham, vice versa. 80% front, 100% rear was not uncommon. Clark had such incredible balance that he was able to use all four corners of the car to the optimum, so that the result was that he would have used up all four tyres at exactly the same rate. There was a difference of a matter of 1% between all four corners of a car driven by Clark. It showed a sensitivity to the way the car behaved, a sensitivity to what the surface allowed, and an awareness of what he could do that bordered on the incredible. At Reims in 63, it should be added, Clark also won his third straight race on the same set of Dunlop tyres. Most of all, though, I remember Clark for his sheer love of the sport. He raced Formula 2, sports cars, touring cars, and GT cars to win. But he wasn't afraid of being beaten by a superior car-driver combination. This was a part of motor racing. This was what he enjoyed, and he shared those victories with others. That's why he listened to his friend Dan Gurney when Dan suggested that Jim take the Formula One Lotus to Indy for a test late in 1962. That's why he drove Peter Westbury's four-wheel drive Felday sports car at Brands in 66. That's why he tried the Honourable Patrick Lindsay's ERA during a quiet moment in practice at Rouen in 64. That's why he ran as high as 6 in the 1966 RAC rally with a Lotus Cortina. That's why Jochen Rindt and Jackie Stewart hesitated at the end of the 1967 season when they were asked whether they wanted to try a NASCAR race with Ford. That's why Jim accepted the same invitation spontaneously and threw in a USAC event with a car named the Volstead Ford for good measure. Jim didn't need constantly to prove that he was the best or ever to speak about it. He was a man of humility and dignity who never forgot his obligation to the spectators who paid to see him drive. That's why he was at Formula 2 Hockenheim in April 1968, racing in the midfield with the difficult Lotus 48, fighting poor handling on a greasy ribbon of track between the trees in the rain. ...1965 British Grand Prix, Silverstone. Mary Quant sculpted her miniskirts in 65, and Colin Chapman gave us the Lotus 33B Climax. Along with its distant cousins, the Ferraris with the blue wheels, the polychromatic green and fluorescent orange nose BRMs, the green and gold Brabhams and the Bruce McLaren Coopers, the Lotus 33B was the nicest looking thing you'd seen this side of, I don't know, Julie Christie. 1.5 litres those Formula One cars may have been, eternal with their looks and lines. At Silverstone in 1965 at the British Grand Prix, Jim Clark strolled to the grid wearing a fawn cardigan over his blue Dunlop overalls, the cardigan that Sally Stokes had given him for Christmas in 1964. As with all the drivers on all the cars that day, his name was big on the side of the car, Clark. In the red upholstered seat of the 33B sat his dark blue Bell Magnum with its trim white peak. For this race, he chose tan kangaroo skin Jim Clark driving gloves from a range that also included red and black. Already in 1965, he had recovered from a slip disc and had won the South African, Dutch and French Grand Prix, plus the Indianapolis 500 and the Tasman Series. No one in the Silverstone crowd denied they were about to see an absolute master again at work. It wouldn't matter if the race was another Jim Clark walkover, for that was as it should be. The spectators accepted Clark for what he was, a quiet genius who was also a sheep farmer from the Scottish borders. There were no complaints back then about the lack of overtaking or the one or two place changes that would invariably characterise a race. In 1965, when the Beatles had yet to grow their hair long and Mini Coopers were genuinely mini, like the Mary Quant skirts, and the girls wore headscarves when they rode in open-topped MG Midgets, life was there to be touched, not consumed in ever larger forkfuls. For much of the distance, the race indeed belonged to Clark and the Team Lotus 33B. Graham Hill in the BRM, absolutely a part of the BRM, with his graceful opposite lock slides and his London Rowing Club Everoak helmet looking as though they were the two key figures around which Tony Rudd had designed the car, pushed Jim hardest. By three-quarter distance, however, the race seemed to be clearly another one for Clark. By lap 64, with 16 to run, Hill was some 35 seconds away in second place. Then Jim's Climax V8 began to lose oil pressure, first at Stowe, momentarily, and then at Club and Woodcote. On the straights, the needle would flicker back to centre. With every passing lap, though, the plunges grew ever worse. A blow-up, a rare blow-up in this final year for Coventry Climax in Formula One, seemed inevitable. What to do? What to do? With no radio communication, Colin Chapman and Chief Mechanic Dick Scammell were oblivious to the problem. They could hear reports of what seemed to be a misfire, but on the pit straight, the Climax engine still sounded strong. Jim needed to think it out for himself. Think it out with all his brain power and with the experience of those days as a part-time mechanic in the Jock McBain garage in Chernside and the time spent in many a track and roadside moment trying to mend a broken Lotus. Even in 1965, Jim could often be seen helping with wheel changes or plug checks or obscure misfire diagnoses at major races throughout the world. And so he decided on a cure. He decided to kill the engine through all the fast corners, thus minimizing the piston or main bearing damage when the surge was at its greatest and the lubricant at its thinnest. He would think it through and then he would do it. He would approach Stowe in top, brake and change down to fourth, and then find neutral at probably 140 miles an hour before switching off the engine. He would then have no throttle to help him balance the slide. He would not be able to apply any power until the 33B was straight. But instead, Jim realized that he was going to have to attempt an even earlier than normal approach to the corner, an approach based around exactly the right moment and speed at which to rotate the car, and then, when it was more or less straight, to declutch it back into life. All this without losing too much time to Graham Hill. Prior to the problem, Jim had been lapping comfortably in the mid-33s, 34s. Now, in switch-off mode, his lap times were up in the 35s and 36s. Stowe, Club, Woodcote, Jim focused his declutching remedy on these three long, fast corners. At Copse and at Beckett's, he kept the engine running, but again tried extending the straights as much as possible. This was, in any event, his style, his approach to the art of driving. Only the year before, when he'd been giving Colin Chapman a ride around Silverstone in a Lotus Cortina, his boss had been surprised by what he perceived to be Jim's very early approach to the corners. Jim had replied that this was the way he'd always driven, regardless of whether he was in a Formula One car, the Lotus 30, the Cortina, or the Formula 2 Lotus 35. Now, in these excruciatingly long and dramatic closing minutes of the British Grand Prix, he was turning into all the corners even earlier. He could hear the Dunlop tyres scrubbing off speed in the bland silence of the cut engine, mid-stow, but only in the distance, as if he was vaguely aware of an aircraft flying overhead. His mind, his concentration was a tunnel. Feel the moment. Apply the steering lock. Now. Engage third. Declutch. Now. Dick Scammell's pit signals narrated a story he didn't want to read. Once before, at the 62 International Trophy at Silverstone, Graham had passed him on the line. Literally on the line. Bruce McLaren had also pipped in the same way in a mini race, but that was another story. Today it was different. Today it was Jim Clark versus the failing engine. It was the Lotus 33B, with all its grip and balance and drivability, suddenly racing within itself. And he was the man in the middle. Three laps to go. Two. Amazingly, he had consistently managed to keep his lap times about 2.5 seconds adrift of par. Once or twice, the engine had sputtered before screaming back to life. He could see Graham in his mirrors as he reached top gear on Hangar Straight. Concentrate. One more time around Stowe, one more around Club. The crowd in his peripheral vision was a waving sea of arms. Graham was with him now, catching him assuredly. Jim relit the climax one more time. Third, fourth, Abbey Curve, fifth, down to Woodcote, fourth, extend the straight, delay the lateral load, power on, checkered flag. Last lap, 1 minute 36.8, enough to win by the margin of 3.2 seconds. As he crossed the line, Colin Chapman threw his cap skywards and shouted, "He's done it! Would you believe it? He's done it!" Jim, the Lotus 33B, Colin, the entire Lotus race team, and Clive Chapman, who was there for the day, were towed on a trailer behind a tractor for the crowds to celebrate after the race. It was cold and Jim had left the cardigan behind. Jim Endrewhite immediately took off his pullover and gave it to Jim, who put it on over his blue Dunlop overalls. What a time. The next day, in the style of the era, the newspapers would report that Jim Clark was forced to nurse his engine in the closing laps due to a mechanical problem, with emphasis on Graham Hill's fighting finish. There was nothing more, no more detail. It was easy reading. Something about which to talk, a little. No one suggested, as I do now, that not a single other driver in the history of our sport, with the possible exception of Stirling Moss of that time, could have won that race that day in the way that Jim Clark won at Silverstone.